You're listening to Greater LA from KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
All rise for the Honorable Judge Marshall Stephen.
Let's face it, unless you're a lawyer or a judge, or maybe a cop, a lot of your knowledge of how the criminal justice system works probably comes from a movie or a TV show, including the idea of money bail.
I'm going to set your bail at $3,000.
Your bail is $20,000.
$50,000 bail.
$2,000 and better throw this jackass out of my court!
Yes, Your Honor.
If you pay a set bail amount, you don't have to stay in jail between your arrest and your trial. It's also thought that paying bail gives you an incentive to stay out of additional trouble, assuming you're guilty, of course, and an incentive to show up for your trial. But critics say the money bail system is exploitative and riddled with injustices that hurt the poorest of the accused. Those are reasons why Los Angeles County just eliminated cash bail for many criminal offenses. And that sparked a backlash from people who say that is a recipe for creating even more crime. Saul Gonzalez is LA's co-host of KQED's The California Report, and he picks up the story from here.
On a recent morning, a throng of reporters gathered at the Superior Court building in Van Nuys. They were there for something that usually gets little media attention, a bail hearing. But this hearing was for Fraser Michael Baum. Baum's the 22-year-old who's accused of killing four Pepperdine University students on Pacific Coast Highway in October when he struck the students with his BMW at more than 100 miles per hour, according to authorities. Baum's bail was set at $4 million for multiple counts of murder and vehicular manslaughter, a figure Baum's defense attorney, Michael Kraut, complained to me was too high and unnecessary.
The issue is, how does it affect public safety? Because if they allow him out at $4 million and he was able to afford it, and they give the same restrictions of don't drive, don't have weapons, and don't harm anybody, what's the difference between doing that at $100,000? The bail becomes punitive.
Baum's affluent family was able to post the $4 million bail, and he's now out of jail as he awaits trial. But what if you don't have money to afford bail and the freedom that paying it brings?
If you don't have the money, don't have family to help you out, you're going to sit there and suffer. Like, nobody wants to be in jail. It really sucks.
That's James White, who I also met at the Van Nuys courthouse on the same morning as Fraser Michael Baum's bail hearing. White says he once got arrested for small-time drug possession and couldn't afford the $1,500 bail amount set for him.
So what did not being able to pay bail mean for you?
I'd have to stay in jail until I figure it out. It's hard on everybody because they got a job or they got a house or apartment. They can't pay their bills. They can't go and do things they have to do before they get arrested.
James White and Fraser Michael Baum are examples of the central role money has long played in determining who stays behind bars and who doesn't in the criminal justice system. Just ask David Slayton.
If you make bail, you're out. If you don't make bail, you're in.
Slayton is the executive officer of LA County Superior Court System.
And so the ways that that can happen are, again, you know, traditionally money bail. So people pay some sum of money either in cash to the court, or they contract with a bond company, a bail bond company, to put up some promise of money to get out. It's the only way to get out of jail pre-conviction.
And if you do turn to a bail bond agency, it'll often keep 10% of the posted bail, whether you're found guilty or innocent. So if you pay a $50,000 bail, the median bail amount in California, bond agencies will keep $5,000. But because of a judge's ruling earlier this year, Los Angeles County's money bail system is ending for all kinds of criminal offenses. It's a big change with huge consequences, says Slayton.
You know, obviously, it impacts everyone. All of us who are members of this community are concerned about public safety. And so making sure that we get this right is really important.
Starting last month, most people who are arrested in LA County for what the state classifies as nonviolent, non-serious misdemeanors and felonies, which includes most thefts and vehicle violations, are being released quickly and without paying a single cent of bail. That has criminal justice reform advocates like Professor Alicia Varani with UCLA's Pretrial Justice Clinic cheering. Varani calls the money bail system, as it's long existed, discriminatory and unfair.
It is unjust because the same two people charged with the same
crime, same criminal history, same everything. One person has the funds to pay their bail amount and can secure their release pre-trial and go on living their life. And the other person is unable to simply because of what is not in their wallet, which leads to a whole host of negative collateral consequences for the individual who cannot pay.
Those consequences can be lost work days, not being able to get needed health care, or missing family responsibilities. But the elimination of money bail as a remedy to inequity has sparked a backlash in a county where concerns about crime are high. More than two dozen cities in LA County, including Santa Monica, Beverly Hills, Lancaster, and Downey, have sued the county over its bail reforms, arguing they're a threat to public safety. Claudia Frometta is the mayor of Downey.
You know, the message that we're sending criminals is, you know, there's impunity. They will be cited and released.
And the bail reforms have become a regular punching bag on conservative talk radio like KFI.
In summary, most arrestees will not be held in custody, but instead released immediately.
Right. So the guy can steal my car and he's not going to spend a minute in jail.
Remember, this is all part of a reform package.
No. Reform is a crap word. That's another one of these euphemisms they use to cover up their anarchy.
There's also opposition to bail reform within the criminal justice system.
My fear is that people who should be in custody are not in custody.
That's Eric Siddall, an LA County Deputy District Attorney who's now a candidate for DA.
It is very logical that someone who has a gun, who is a serious or violent felon, should not be roaming the streets immediately after they were caught with their gun. I think it's extremely dangerous because a violent felon with a gun is basically an attempted murder waiting to happen.
But David Slayton of LA County Superior Court says what's dangerous is the amount of bail reform misinformation and exaggeration out there.
You know, what I've heard people talk about is that there's no accountability, that no one can be booked in the jail anymore, that it's catch and release. And every single one of those statements is 100% false.
Slayton reminds the public that capital crimes, such as murder, still aren't eligible for zero-money bail release, like Fraser Michael Baum, who's charged with killing the four Pepperdine students. And many people accused of serious offenses like sexual battery are now subject to a judicial magistrate's review of their criminal record before they're let go without bail. Slayton says in many cases, that will mean people who pre-reforms would have automatically left custody if they could post bail will now stay behind bars.
And so what's changed now is that instead of focusing on the money situation, we are doing an individualized determination of each person's risk to the public and risk to the victim safety and risk of not showing back up to court. In fact, what the data shows is that there are many people that are being arrested for these offenses, which are high risk, that would otherwise have been getting out on money, where our judges are saying there are no conditions under which we can safely release this person in the community pre-arraignment. And so those people are being held.
An early study by the LA Superior Court shows that the first few weeks of LA County's bail reforms seem to be working, with a tiny fraction of people who've been booked and then released without paying bail getting rebooked. Reform advocates say that shows it's possible to remedy injustices in the bail system while keeping the people of Los Angeles County safe. For KCRW, I'm Saul Gonzalez.
Coming up, there's a bunch of hate in the world, different levels of it, of course, with different reactions. But what's at the heart of hate? There's a lot of research going on here in LA, and you're going to hear about it on the other side of this.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Hate. It's an emotion that seems to dominate far too much of society these days. There's a lot of it in the world, always has been. It fuels division and arguments and, yes, violence. Right here in Los Angeles, all around the world for that matter. But what is hate exactly? Why do you and I feel it sometimes? And what can you do to understand and overcome it, to create a more empathetic and peaceful world? Those questions are what prompted researchers over at UCLA to launch an initiative to study hate last year. And now, with a year under their belts, the project's director, David Myers, is here to talk about what they've learned so far. David, welcome to you.
Thank you, Steve.
Before we get into what you all are studying, let me ask a question that I'm sure you've mulled over for a long time. How do you actually define hate?
Oh, this is the eternal question. It has vexed researchers who devote themselves to this topic for decades. You know, what I would begin to say is that there are benign and malign forms of hate. We could say, you know, I hate the Boston Celtics. But that doesn't really capture what hate as a dangerous phenomenon in society really represents. It's more when we say, I hate those people. And among the features that I would point to that help us understand what hate is, first, it's a very intense form of emotion. It's not a fleeting or short-term emotion. It's not like episodic or momentary anger. It's more persistent. And it's also not mild. It's intense. It also often has consequences that come with it. There's often an action that we attach to it, a desire to do harm or eliminate that which we hate. And all of that together can really serve as a glue for solidarity for groups. It serves as a cohesive agent for in-group solidarity.
Yeah, if you all hate the same people, right? If there's a group of people that hates the same, you know, those people, as you mentioned.
That's right. And one of the things that has just long interested me is the way in which that form of hate, that intense fixed hate, can be passed on from generation to generation. Generational hate. One group dislikes another and passes on that hate to the next generation. That's something that, you know, we really have to try to understand better.
Is there more hate in the world now than there has been? Or is it just the fact that we have so many ways by which to see it, and, you know, social media and television and cameras everywhere?
I think there's more, and I think there's more because we have the force multipliers of social media.
There are also more people, right?
There are more people. There's more crowding. There's more environmental threat. There's more tension in the world. But there's really also the capacity to disseminate hate in an instant and sort of make it a regular part of that which you digest every day.
You did a study, by the way, that involves social media, right?
Yeah, we've had a number of studies as part of our program, as part of the initiative to study hate, one of which focused on the impact of social media on young people, on youth. And we surveyed over 7,500 respondents and found that over 80% of young people encountered hate speech within the last month. And 47% of them have reported that they've been bullied over social media. The team that's working on this is developing guidelines to share with school districts, educators, teachers, parents about how to regulate and mitigate the effects of social media.
You also have neuroscientists looking at how hate actually functions in the brain. I mean, how do you even do that? I mean, is that with like MRIs, CAT scans? What do you do?
Yeah, imaging, brain imaging. Yeah, it's one of the most promising directions, I think, in the study of hate. And what our neuroscience team has been doing is imaging the inferior frontal cortex by taking a group of participants, exposing them to vignettes that involve fictitious groups that display a hateful behavior or not, and seeing how the brain reacts. And what the team has discovered so far is that neurotypical people, when exposed to such vignettes, can lapse into a form of dehumanization called animalistic dehumanization, which regards others as inferior and worthy of contempt and dismissal, which is closely correlated to hate itself.
I mean, there's real impact to hate as well in LA, locally. Some of the work that you've done involves homelessness.
That's right. Again, another one of the teams that is part of the initiative to study hate last year explored the stigmatization and harassment of people experiencing homelessness. It looked at the way media represented people experiencing homelessness and saw that there's a close correlation between the unhoused population and images of danger and violence. But there's a bit of good news in the story, and that is that in the last year that was surveyed, 21-22, it showed that the coverage shifted from that association between homeless people and danger and violence to a sense in which the very condition of homelessness was seen as a danger to homeless people, not the danger caused by homeless people. So our research is uncovering interesting trend lines, and some of them, I'm glad to say, are moving in the right direction.
There are certainly other things going on in the world, though, and I wonder, you know, your work is not done yet. You've got a lot going on. The research is before you, and you've got more to do. Has it given you any hope for solutions that we can understand? We can understand why people hate, right? And we can see it, you know, with our own eyes, but is there a solution to it? Is there a way to mitigate what happens when someone hates?
Yeah, I don't think there's a single magic pill that will dissolve or eliminate hate from our society. I think we have to approach it through a multidisciplinary approach that understands that hate manifests in many different ways, in many different forms, in many different corners of society, at many age levels. And really only by exploring sort of the multiple dimensions of hate will we be able to develop effective mitigation strategies. We really think in the future there may be ways to deflect or diffuse those impulses toward animalistic dehumanization that take rise in the brain. And I also say one of the interesting projects that we have now is examining the way in which music can serve as a source of reducing inter-ethnic and religious tensions in India. We have a very interesting research team working on the complex relations between Hindus and Muslims in India, and the way in which in a certain region of India, music has been deployed quite effectively as a means of diffusing the longstanding hate between those two groups.
Well, music certainly does bring a lot of people together, for sure. David Myers, director of UCLA's Initiative to Study Hate. David, thanks for coming on, for talking with us about it.
Thank you so much for having me, Steve.
Moving on now with Greater LA from KCRW, I'm Steve Chiotakis. After experiencing a string of anti-Semitic comments directed at him online, Jewish comedian Alex Edelman decided to confront the harassment at the source. So during an evening in 2017, Edelman snuck into a white nationalist meetup. Yeah, his ensuing experience became the source material for his current one-man show called Just for Us. The show wrapped up its Broadway run back in August after stops in D.C. and London. It's garnered rave reviews along the way, and now it's playing L.A. And the comedian and star of the show, Alex Edelman, is with us to talk about it. Hi, Alex.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
The story about attending the white nationalist meeting is true, right? What happened that night?
It's true, but as I always tell people, and I'm very careful to tell people, it is exaggerated for comedy and clarity, and that is really important because my director, Adam Brace, once I mentioned when we were working on the show initially, he went, that thing needs to come out. And I went, it's true. And he went, shame it isn't funny.
Ooh.
Yes, it was a very good line. But yeah, I'm always careful to tell people that it is. Actually, you know, everything in my life is up for grabs. I'm not even Jewish, frankly. I'm a devout member of the Nation of Islam. So, you know, it's all right. For the act.
I mean, you put yourself out there, right? I mean, don't you want your true self to be out there, Alex?
My true self is out there, but, you know, that's also what the show is about. The show is sort of about the sort of versions that we present to ourselves to be likable and the things that we omit to fit into, you know, I don't want to spoil the show, so I'm very careful about what to.
Of course.
And, you know, I will always speak to people. I wait outside after every show and talk to whoever has questions. And they're, you know, pretty honest. But, you know, we keep lots of things from each other for the sake of fitting in. And so that's what the show is more broadly about.
You know, the thing about it is, and here's the conundrum that we have right now, because you and I are talking about this during some really serious times. I mean, there's just a show going on in the world, right? Mm-hmm. And you're trying to be funny, and I'm trying to be informative. And I guess what I'm asking of you is to because you're a comedian, to be funny. But we're not talking about funny stuff, right? And so there's
we are
this,
talking about funny
well,
stuff.
Well, we are because you went to a, you know, presumably a white nationalist meeting, and you're explaining what happened. And I guess for somebody who's listening to this right now, if you're listening to this right now, what do you get from your show when you leave, when you're done? Alex Edelman is done. The stage show is finished. I'm leaving. What do I have?
First of all, the show is not about Israel and Palestine. The show is about Jews and their relationship to whiteness, and not even Jews, one Jew and his relationship to whiteness. And it's not even about that. It's about jokes. It's about stories. And it's about if somebody got a sitter and paid money for a ticket, they had a really good night out, which is why I think the show has been warmly received, which is that it was created with care for an audience's entertainment above all else. It is a piece of entertainment that highlights, you know, certain key issues. But if you are curious about the question that informs the show, I guess, which is what is a Jew's place in the world, specifically one Jew, specifically Alex Edelman, specifically this overmedicated Bostonian, you are free to apply what you've learned to maybe current events. I mean, you don't have to. There's no requirement. There's no imperative. I'm not even pushing people in that direction. I'm just saying, for me, the question, what is a Jew's place in the world, does seem more urgent and visceral now. So I guess all I'd say is that if you come to the show and you have a big question when you leave that spurs conversation, that's the entire goal. If you had a great time and you have something to talk about afterwards, that's great. I'd say the best part of the show, doing it in New York when I was off Broadway, was you know, going into the restaurant next door to the Cherry Lane Theater where I was doing it, and hearing people argue about sort of identity and sort of what their identity means to them, because the show's not just about Jews and their relationship to, you know, to the world that they live in. It's about anyone who comes from a specific group and wonders if they can live in the world as it is now without compromising elements of their identity.
Alex Edelman, comedian, singular star of the one-man show Just For Us, the show running at the Mark Taper Forum starting tomorrow through November 26th. Alex, thanks for coming on. Good luck with the show.
Thanks so much for having me, and I'm so looking forward to doing the show and making folks laugh. It's a real delight.
That's all the time we have for this evening. Tomorrow at this time, it's The Business, and legendary sitcom director James Burrows is in to talk about the revival of Frasier on Paramount Plus and his career directing shows such as Taxi and Cheers and Will and Grace. Next week on GLA, LA Metro is rolling out a pilot program of phone-enabled public restrooms. How's that going to go? Will it help solve a public urination problem? And a book club in Venice reads aloud a James Joyce classic, one page at a time, and it's only taken 28 years. And how's the transition going over at LADWP to getting energy from renewable sources? The utility has a goal. Is it on track to meet that goal? All next week, right here on Greater LA. And always online, by the way, at kcrw.com/GLA. Have a story idea for us? Maybe you want to share something with us. You can get the podcast, too, so you can get the show on the go. It's all there, kcrw.com/GLA. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthew, Kelsey Gante, Eddie Sun, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Eben Ray, Jocelyn Robach, and Christian Bordahl all helped run this evening's episode. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for the ear. Have a great night.